Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point. More top brass changes at the White House. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster is shipped out. Bush-era hawk John Bolton steps in. Congress works out a deal to keep the government open. Will the president veto? Also this week, there was blowback on both sides of the aisle when President Trump ignored an all-caps warning not to call Putin after his, quote, victory in the Russian elections.
I had a call with President Putin and congratulated him on the victory, his electoral victory.
There's more drama unfolding in the president's personal life. Three women from his past are now suing him. One of them, former Playboy model Karen McDougal, who is seeking to invalidate a legal agreement to stay silent, described her affair with the president in an interview with CNN.
He's so sweet. Like what everyone sees on TV, I didn't see in that man, because that man was very sweet, very respectful, very loving, very kind and caring. Like that's the man I saw.
And protests erupted last night in Sacramento over the police shooting of an unarmed 22-year-old black man, Stephen Clark, at his grandmother's backyard Sunday. Here's protester Barry Assias.
They said it was a toolbar. They said it was a gun. And now, when you see it, they said he had a cell phone and then yelled, he has a gun. And then all of a sudden, they shot him dead.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Yamiche Alcindor, Tamara Keith, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online. What do you think of John Bolton as the new national security advisor? News that President Trump's top lawyer of the Russia probe has quit. Join us anytime on onpointradio.org or on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Arlington, Virginia is Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Yamiche, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, Tamara Keith, White House correspondent for NPR. Tamara, thanks for joining us, too.
Glad to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie joins us. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Kimberly, Yamiche, and Tamara.
So let's start off by talking about this budget that may face a veto. Just a little while ago, this morning, the president tweeted, "I am considering a veto of the omnibus spending bill based on the fact that 800,000 plus DACA recipients have been totally abandoned by the Democrats, not even mentioned in the bill. And the border wall, which is desperately needed for our national defense, is not fully funded." Now, the president, the White House floated this temporary deal to temporarily protect DACA recipients in exchange for border funding, but he repeatedly rejected bipartisan plans for a more permanent fix. Yamiche, where does this leave us?
People on both sides of the aisle, especially the Democrats, have long thought that President Trump didn't want a deal that included DACA precisely because he could then hang it over Democrats' heads and make them look bad in front of their base. As soon as the omnibus bill was essentially finalized, I started getting, and I'm sure a lot of reporters started getting, emails from Hispanic caucus members and other people who were basically making the claim that Democrats had left behind Latino young people, undocumented young people who were counting on the Democrats to push forward. Now, of course, the Democrats shut down the government, or, you know, they argue over who shut down the government, but the Democrats at least pushed the issue so that there was, in the middle of this government shutdown that we had, so that DACA recipients were really at the forefront of their minds for a while. The problem is that the sources that I talk to say that, and the sources that I talk to are Democrats on the Hill, they say that Democrats got spooked and they realized that there were a lot of people who didn't, a lot of lawmakers who didn't want to die on a hill with the DACA recipients. And as a result, they kind of lost their gutso. And now you have an omnibus bill that doesn't deal with that. So here is Donald Trump trying to come in as the savior. But it's pretty hard for him to make that claim because DACA recipients understand given that he was also the one who ended the DACA program. But it's really remarkable that he's now talking about vetoing this bill because the White House officials had thrown their support behind the bill. They met with congressional leaders, with Paul Ryan, and assured them that they were going to support this bill. And here you have the president backing out of that.
Yeah, yeah. And Tamara, meanwhile, Defense Secretary Mattis called the president to warn him that vetoing the spending bill would be a threat to the defense. What might happen if the president vetoes this bill?
Well, I think that there are a lot of unanswered questions about that right now, including, you know, up on Capitol Hill, they don't really know what to make of this threat. And they're scrambling, trying to figure out, well, do they have to pass some sort of stopgap spending measure to prevent a government shutdown? Because, I mean, the clock is ticking on a potential government shutdown. And basically, the Congress has gone home. Because they passed this really big, more than 2,000-page piece of legislation that was supposed to settle the fights over government spending through September and provide some certainty to the government. The president of the United States had committed to congressional leaders that he was going to sign it. Vice President Mike Pence yesterday, campaigning in New Hampshire, giving a speech in New Hampshire, said, you know, touted the wall funding, the border security funding, and in the legislation, and said it was headed to the president's desk. Yeah. And now the president is, you know, creating suspense, which is something that he specializes in.
And as our airtime, that suspense looms. Now, let's talk about if he signs it, Jack. It's a $1.3 trillion bill, not exactly a conservative budget hawk's dream, huh?
No. And of course, that's been one of the marks of the Trump year and a quarter. The booming of the national debt and deficit. And he's gotten people from the conservative side of the House have complained volubly about this. But the president seems to have taken on board the counsel of Dick Cheney that deficits don't matter. The public doesn't seem to care about them. But everybody says that one effect of the deficits through the kind of connection with increased interest rates, probably one sure effect, is that the dollar will strengthen, and that will make it harder to export U.S. goods. And that will have a deleterious effect on manufacturing employment, the very thing the president wants to increase.
All right. And other breaking news in the last 24 hours, John Bolton tapped as the new national security advisor for President Trump. H.R. McMaster is out. Yamiche, this has been a long time in the making, despite White House denials. It seems that McMaster and Trump just never clicked.
The reporting that I'm hearing and the reporting that I'm doing tells me that the White House is trying to spin this as something that was planned and that was not a bumpy rollout. But John Bolton himself said that he was surprised that this news broke yesterday because he didn't expect it in his first interview on Fox News. The White House had been denying for weeks now that H.R. McMaster was on his way out. As soon as the news broke, there were so many people retweeting Sarah Sanders' tweet from March 15th saying that the president has a good working relationship with H.R. McMaster and that everything was going to go well. But what happened here is that the president wants people who are going to be yes men to him. He wants people who are going to be loyal to him and who are in some ways going to validate the opinions that he's already formed. And in John Bolton, he has someone that doesn't really actually have the same thoughts or opinions as him, but as he has someone who has now, as a Fox analyst, might now just back up what the president wants to hear.
And we know the president loves Fox.
Yeah, the president, of course, loves Fox, so it's not surprising that he would watch his TV and say, I want that guy in my office now. But there's this idea that John Bolton is someone who's hawkish. He still backs going into the Iraq war as of today. He's someone who said that an offensive strike on North Korea might be something that's a good idea. So the president campaigned on this idea that the Iraq war was not a good idea and that America needed to be less involved in other countries. And his voters that I talked to all throughout the 2016 campaign voted for him because of that reason. And now he has someone that is kind of the complete opposite, but who might turn out to just be a yes man.
Yeah. But one of the things that John Bolton has said was that the Russian meddling in the election was a true act of war. Maybe he and the president disagrees a little bit there. Another ouster, John Dowd, has left. Joseph DiGenova was apparently the last draw for Trump's lead lawyer in the Mueller probe. Tamara, what's the impact of that?
Yeah, and I spoke with Dowd yesterday. He wouldn't say why he was quitting, but he did say that he loves the president and wishes him well. And others that I've spoken to, another source says that, Dowd was frustrated, under-resourced, tired, and that the president wasn't listening to him. And in particular on Joe DiGenova, the other lawyer that was brought in, sort of blindsiding Dowd, there's concern that Dowd, according to my source, expressed to the president that DiGenova has conflicts of interest because he has this very small law firm with his wife that already represents a couple of people who've sat down with Robert Mueller's team. Mm-hmm. So there's all of that. But in terms of what it means for direction, if you look at the things that DiGenova has said on TV, he has very much gone after the entire investigation. He has gone after the FBI and the Justice Department, or at least parts of it, and said that this is all a conspiracy to get Donald Trump. Mm. And that very much channels the way the president feels about it based on his tweets. But it is a change in direction. You know, there had been a sort of a philosophy coming from at least parts of the president's legal team that there should be cooperation with Mueller, that if they just cooperated, this, you know, the president would be exonerated and it would all go away. And now that there's a shift there.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about the week's top stories. You can join the conversation. Are we looking at a trade war with China? How bothered are you about the president's congratulatory call to Putin? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour are Tamara Keith of NPR, Yamiche Alcindor of PBS, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Yesterday, President Trump imposed tariffs on $60 billion worth of Chinese goods. Besides the lost American jobs Trump's blames on China, he said the measure is retaliation for China stealing American technology.
We have a tremendous intellectual property theft situation going on, which likewise is hundreds of billions of dollars.
So, Jack, China is threatening to retaliate with tariffs on U.S. goods. Are we heading for a trade war?
We seem to be at the verge of one. China talking about 25% tariff on American pork, 15% on steel pipes, fruit, wine. And as one expert said, the Chinese are keenly aware of the American Electoral College and that they will tailor their retaliatory tariffs to states that are crucial in that college. So a trade war seems to be a brewing. But that, I think, is not the main threat right now. The main threat is a real war. That's the significance of John Bolton. It can't be overstated how dangerous this appointment is. This man has a proven record of being catastrophically wrong about the major blunder of U.S. foreign policy in the post-war era, the war in Iraq, and he still maintains that that was a justified war. He has a kind of omnidirectional, I think, mindless pugnacity, ready here to bomb there, bomb here. He has no regard for Congress's role in declaring war, and he is apt to the president is going to be sorely tempted to escape from his the Mueller investigation, from the other matters that are assailing him domestically, to escape in a foreign adventure, and James Madison, in arguing that the power to declare war should be with Congress, spoke of that as the power to declare war, the temptation too great for any one man. It's going to be very great for the president in coming weeks, and he's going to be hearing all the wrong things if you value peace from John Bolton.
All right. Amber is calling from South Berwick, Maine. Hi, Amber.
Hi, Kim.
Go ahead. You're on with our panel.
Hi there. I would just like to point out that while I am not a fan of President Trump, and I have not been, the only thing he's done that has piqued my interest and that I moderately support are his tariffs on aluminum and steel, because I do believe that something to boost our economy and our domestic manufacturing would benefit this country. And while I don't agree that it's good for our allies, and I think that some negotiation should probably happen there, is it really bad that we take steps like this to improve our own economy first?
All right. Thanks for the call, Amber. Yamiche, what about that? How are these tariffs being received by the public, by Congress?
I think the caller's point of view is one that people who supported Donald Trump might also hold. When I went to the Midwest, thinking of Michigan and I guess more on the East Coast, Pennsylvania, people definitely felt as though, and I would say because I covered Bernie Sanders' campaign too, people who also supported Bernie Sanders felt as though America was being taken advantage of by the greater world, in that China, they felt as though the manufacturing jobs that their grandparents and they had were then taken from China and taken to Mexico, and that America had to do some sort of aggressive trade tariffs to try to bring those jobs back, or to at least make those countries make it harder for those countries to delve into American policies or American manufacturing. That said, people on lawmakers, I think both Republicans and Democrats, have their questions about how this is going to turn around and affect the U.S. down the line, especially when you think of how China might retaliate. There were some reports already that China had said that they were going to essentially hit back, and that could be disastrous in some ways because the U.S. buys so much from China, and also because China has so much of our debt. So I think there's some real worries from people who really study how U.S. debt and how our foreign policies work. But on the ground, I think people are feeling very pushed over by China and want the U.S. to do something.
All right, Michael is on the line from Baltimore. Hi there, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm not typically a supporter of President Trump and his policies, but in this case, I feel like with China, the very low innovation, anti-competitive country that commonly chokes out U.S. business in their country and floods the market with heavily subsidized products, I think we do need to get a little tougher. I think it's a major threat to us economically. I'm not an economist, and I'm not going to say that I know how to do that. Neither that President Trump does, but I do enjoy a bit of a tougher tone, not just defaulting to the WTO, and it's been refreshing. Thank you.
And thank you for that, Michael. And the New York Times, in an editorial, agrees that the U.S. needs to get tougher on China and praises Trump's challenge to China's use of technology licensing policies. But it still says tariffs are blunt tools that are far less effective than Mr. Trump realizes. Tamara, speak a little bit to that. How effective might this plan be? Is it too broad? Is it surgical enough, as we kept hearing lawmakers telegraph that it needs to be?
Well, when President Trump did the steel and aluminum tariffs, there were a lot of members of Congress who said, why are you doing this sort of scattershot, wide, broad thing when – when the real concern is China. And a lot of people on Capitol Hill and elsewhere feel that China really is a problem. And other administrations have wanted to deal with China's unfair trade practices as well, and faced the problem that China is also an ally that, well, sort of an ally. The U.S. needs China, yeah. Particularly for matters like in dealing with North Korea. And it's not clear, you know, how this will all play out. At the moment, China's reaction has been relatively surgical and smaller than some were expecting. But there's also some talk that that could just be the beginning, that they're just sort of feeling out how this goes.
In other news, there was a call heard around the world and a warning to President Trump that wasn't heard or at least heeded at all. Do not congratulate, the president was told, yet he still called President Vladimir Putin to congratulate him after the elections, whose fairness is questionable, of course. President Trump called Vladimir Putin, despite that note from his national security team, and here's his reaction about that call.
We had a very good call, and I suspect that we'll probably be meeting in the not-too-distant future to discuss the arms race, which is getting out of control, but we will never allow anybody to have anything even close to what we have, and also to discuss Ukraine and Syria and North Korea and various other things.
But beyond the subject of that call, Jack, the president expressed outrage that the fact that he was told not to congratulate Vladimir Putin was leaked. Even folks who disagreed with the president's decision to call expressed support for his outrage that someone from his inner circle would drop that information to reporters. Jack, what do you think?
Well, there's another way to look at that, and that is that that person is a patriot, that person saw that the president really is the question here is the president's loyalty. I mean, I really think it's that fundamental. And there's been a kind of barrier broken this week in a sort of ferocity of candor about Mr. Trump. Clint Watts, the FBI cyber security expert who made news for his eloquent testimony before Congress, Clint Watts came out and said flatly, Mr. Putin owns Trump. John Brennan, the former CIA director, I think he's afraid of the president of Russia. I think they have long experience with Mr. Trump and may have things they could expose. Barry McCaffrey, the general, says that Mr. Trump is, quote, a risk to national security. So the person that leaked this, I think, saw what the president did in that light. Who is the president finally loyal to the United States above Russia or not? When is he going to stop showing, as the Times put it, that he's that he's not Putin's lackey? It's certainly past time for him to show that. And since this is right at the center of the Mueller inquiry, he has every incentive to show distance from Putin, to criticize Russia, to just speak to the level of events of what Russia is doing. And yet, consistently, he can't criticize this man. It's just beyond argument that Russia has leverage on him, and that brings into question his fundamental loyalty.
Danny's calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Danny.
Hi. I think that Trump and Putin are both the biggest threats to democracy and world peace. And I think that John Bolton is now guarantees. I've always said that Trump would, once Mueller gets close, would start a nuclear war and he would take us with him. And now John Bolton almost guarantees that. Thank you.
What do you think about that, Tamara?
I am not going to make predictions about the future, and certainly not predictions about nuclear war. Certainly, John Bolton is a hawk. There's no denying that. One question about what he'll do as national security advisor is whether he'll be sort of the honest broker that national security advisors typically have been, where they present the president with a bunch of options and don't put their finger on the scales too heavily, or whether he will sort of push the president in a more hawkish direction. Not that the president necessarily needs to be pushed. Reportedly, Bolton promised the president that he wouldn't get the United States into a war if he got this job. So there's that. And regarding the Putin call, President Trump is not the first president of the United States to congratulate Vladimir Putin, but typically it has taken a little bit longer and has come with a message about the need for free and fair elections. This was unique in that respect, in that President Trump just sort of glazed over some of the biggest issues between the U.S. and Russia just in the last week, including the U.S. imposing a bunch of tariffs on new sanctions on Russia,
right,
because of election interference, and also the chemical weapons attack on nerve agent attack on a former Russian spy and his daughter in the UK.
Former CIA Director John Brennan appeared on MSNBC's Morning Joe Wednesday and warned that President Trump's fawning attitude toward Russian President Putin shows that Trump has something to fear from the Russians.
I think he's afraid of the president of Russia.
Why?
Well, I think one can speculate as to why, that the Russians may have something on him personally, that they could always roll out and make his life more difficult. Clearly, I think it's important for us to be able to improve relations with Russia. But the fact that he has had this fawning attitude toward Mr. Putin, has not said anything negative about him, I think continues to say to me that he does have something to fear.
Yamiche, do other people have that same belief that maybe Vladimir Putin has something on Trump?
It's a conspiracy theory that's been, or I guess a theory, maybe not conspiracy theory. It's been a theory that's been going around D.C. for as long as the president has been in office, mainly because there's always that dossier that's been floating around about what kind of scandalous things the president could have been doing and been caught doing, possibly on video in Russia without getting too explicit. So there's this idea that he's not taking this tack because of that. But there are also people that think that maybe it's also because Russia, there's another theory that it's because not so much that Russia personally has something on him, but the fact that they helped him in the election. So that's less of about a scandal and more about what is the ties both financially and politically that this country has to the president's victory. So there's also that issue. But I think that it's unprecedented for this president. I know that's a word that's used a lot with President Trump, but it's such a controversial collegial relationship that he has with Vladimir Putin. And the fact that he would congratulate him over the objections of his own staff tells you that he's really pushing back against even the people that he's paying to give him good advice. And that says something about not only his relationship with Russia, but also his relationship with his own staff members.
Also, this week, more women are launching legal challenges with President Trump, including former porn actress Stormy Daniels and former Playboy model Karen McDougal. Both are seeking to get out of non-disclosure agreements. Jack, what kind of legal and political peril does this pose to the president?
Well, there certainly is going to be some political cost and probably even a personal cost. Mrs. Trump reportedly is, and how could she be otherwise, extremely disturbed by the ubiquity of references to these women, so I think that there'll be some consequence in his personal life, and insofar as some of his supporters at least have reservations about his character. I see that, according to one poll, evangelical women are moving slightly away from him. That's significant, and one of the reasons appears to be this kind of scandal. So it may have that political effect, but it also has a sort of an effect on the national tone. It is so tawdry. He appears to be so tawdry, And he's the president, and people can say, well, the voters knew about all this. They didn't know about all this, by the way. They knew about some of it, and they voted for him, and therefore it's a settled issue. I'm not so clear on that, but that is the argument the president's people make.
All right. And just quickly, Tamara, it seems that members of Congress don't want to touch this at all. Asked about it, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, they take a pass. Why is that?
They probably don't need to get involved in this. The women who are out there trying to tell their stories, and Summer Zervos, the former apprentice contestant who is filing suit against the president, they are doing a very good job of keeping this story in the top of the news.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. In other news this week, the bombing suspect who terrorized residents in Austin, Texas, blew himself up as police closed in. At a press conference Wednesday, Interim Police Chief Brian Manley said the motive is still unknown.
I know everybody is interested in a motive and understanding why, and we are never going to be able to put a ration behind these acts.
On Tuesday, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson distanced himself from a scandal surrounding that purchase of a $31,000 dining room set for his office by blaming his wife.
I'm not really big into decorating. If it was up to me, my office would probably look like a hospital waiting room. But at any rate, you know, I invited my wife to come in and help me.
And following the revelation that Cambridge Analytica gained access to private information of more than 50 million Facebook users, Mark Zuckerberg, his net worth dropped over $5 billion. Here's Trevor Noah's take on how Zuckerberg is handling this.
Seriously, Mark Zuckerberg is not having a good day. Things are so bad for him right now that Facebook is showing him ads for Xanax. Just click here, Zuck. Click here.
You can join the conversation. What do you make of another police shooting of an unarmed black man, this time in Sacramento? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Tamara Keith of NPR, Yamiche Alcindor of PBS, and Jack Beatty. Let's get to Sacramento first, that shooting of Stephon Clark in his grandmother's backyard. He was holding a cell phone. Police say they thought that it was a gun. Protests have already broken out there. Yamiche, how is the impact of this on the country after seeing so many shootings of unarmed black men over the past several years?
It's really a heartbreaking reminder that amidst all the political upheaval and all the things that we talk about, that African-American men and the Black Lives Matter movement have been asking for justice and asking for a change in policing tactics, because it seems as though African-Americans continue to face unjust treatment by police officers. This young man, I don't know the full story, so, you know, the ruling for what happened with the shooting remains to be seen, but the idea and the fact is that he was in the backyard of his grandmother's house. He was holding a cell phone that police thought was a gun. And it's just, he's just one of so many black people, both men and women, who have been shot by the police and that have left people really feeling as though African-Americans are just targeted in a way that just doesn't seem fair. Obviously, there have been police shootings of white people and of white women, but this definitely struck a chord. And I've talked to some activists and seen some activists posting that this is something that still is not to be resolved. The Black Lives Matter movement was born under an African-American president, and President Obama had a task force. Of course, President Trump has taken a completely different tact. He said that he wanted to have a law and order presidency, and he said that the country needs more policing and not less policing, and that the police don't really need reforms. His DOJ has said that the consent decrees that mean that the federal government would need to overlook police departments that have a history of discriminating, that those things shouldn't be in place. So it's really a stark contrast between the two presidents. And I think a lot of activists are feeling very lost right now because they just don't know what to do next and how to stop these things from happening.
Another protest aimed at violence, the March for Our Lives, 500,000 protesters expected in Washington and many more across the country. It would be including Parkland students who's had 17 of their classmates and instructors killed in their school. Now, the president will be at Mar-a-Lago during this March on Washington, but they'll be marching in Parkland too, Tamara. That's just a few dozen miles away from Mar-a-Lago. How might this message resonate with the president, if at all?
It's not clear exactly how it will resonate. Certainly, when the students were out in force on cable television immediately after the shooting, it did affect the president. And that's why he had these listening sessions at the White House and said he absolutely wanted to do something. And then his position changed pretty dramatically from some of the things he had said in those televised listening sessions. So it's not clear whether the president feels like there is more to be done at this point or not. And one question of, I mean, this is kind of ridiculous to say, but one question of how much the images of tomorrow might affect the president is just how much he is consuming the images of tomorrow, whether he stays indoors or whether he spends a lot of time outside.
On the golf course where he tends to be when he's in Florida.
Well, the weather's good.
Yes. Ben is calling from Germantown, Maryland. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Kim. So glad to be here. So I just want to say, as much as we all want to talk about Donald Trump and he is president during these trying times, which involves, you know, an uptick in gun violence, it seems, I feel like the more we focus on Trump, the more we lose sight of what this is really about. This is a march against gun violence. Gun violence has been a potential long before Trump. It's now these issues have really risen to where they're not covert by any means anymore. That being said, I'm extremely happy to see the galvanization that's been occurring, not only within our youth, but within, you know, older people as well. There is a solid connection that's being created that's starting to distill and dismember the stigma that has been holding us back to join forces. And I feel like, you know, what do we do with all this force and all this energy? Well, I believe that leaders will rise in those moments. And I'm so happy to see, you know, people from who are representing local election candidates like Bill Conway, who I'm supporting, and many others for a Montgomery County Council at large. These issues matter not only to the Parkland students, but to all of us.
All right. Thank you for the call, Ben. Jack, another school shooting in St. Mary's County, Maryland. The victim there, Jalen Wiley, is being taken off of life support. Her 17-year-old shooter also died. But in this case, a school resource officer fired shots and is crediting for saving others. That was one of the proposals put forth by President Trump, having armed school resources, school resource officers in place. Do you think that this idea will gain more leverage now?
I don't know. It's certainly in the discussion. But, you know, today's Boston Globe makes an important contribution to the public debate. They have a front page that says 27,000 lives in the balance, what marchers should demand. And they point out that if the whole nation had the same rate of gun violence, gun deaths as Massachusetts, 27,000 lives a year would be saved. Massachusetts has 3.5 deaths per 100,000 residents by gun violence. The national rate is 12 in some states, Alabama, Louisiana, and so on. It's as much as 20. And they go through steps that Massachusetts takes. Now, admittedly, Massachusetts has its own things that are unique to it. But yet, as they lay them out, banning the assault weapon, giving police chiefs the power to decide who gets guns, being extremely careful about persons with severe mental illness getting guns, storing guns safely, all of these things are done in Massachusetts, and they give it the lowest rate in the nation. Done nationally, 27,000 lives a year could be saved. This is a contribution to the students that and to the whole movement, I think, that is worth everyone's attention.
And some breaking news today. The Justice Department on Friday announced charges against 9 Iranians in a government-sponsored hacking scheme that pilfered sensitive information from hundreds of universities, private countries, and private companies and government agencies. The Iranian defendants are accused of working at the behest of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps to steal large quantities of academic data from hundreds of universities in the United States and abroad, as well as email accounts belonging to employees of government agencies and private companies. Back to our discussion about these shootings and these episodes of violence, Yamiche. The shooter in the Maryland case was described as a lovesick teen by police. The Austin serial bomber who blew himself up as police closed in was later described as a challenged young man by police. Yamiche, people are bristling at these characterizations.
People are bristling is a one way to put it. People are really, really mad. Pissed is a better, probably the best way to put it, because for African-Americans that have been posting online and for advocates who have been talking about gun violence and talking about police shootings, they say that these words of sympathetic words about teens and about the background of these people is really something that's a luxury accorded to white people, that this is part of what they think is white privilege in America, that if you are a white man who blows up people in Austin, Texas, or a white man who shoots people in a church like in South Carolina, that somehow there has to be an understanding of, well, the good side of you, that you were quiet, that you were nice. But then when you think of the bombing victims that happened in Austin, there was a young man there that where the police were wondering whether or not he might have blown himself up trying to make the bomb. So there's this idea that a lot of African-Americans feel as though if African-Americans, even if they're a victim of the crime, that they are seen in a less sympathetic way than white men are when they are perpetuating the crimes. That's something that's been going on for a long time, and that a lot of people think has been going on for a long time. As a reporter, I always think that language matters, and that's something that I try to do in my reporting, to try to explain to people, like, hey, we can't use these words if we're going to use terrorists. It can't only be for a certain class of people. And I think media organizations are learning a lot of it. They're having to learn it from readers pushing back on them. But I think that there's a change and a movement to do better in the future, because these are such stark differences.
Mm-hmm. Meredith is calling from Jonesboro, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Meredith.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead. You're on with the panel.
Okay. I just want to say I think there needs to be a fundamental change in the way that we train our police officers, maybe a bigger focus on crisis management rather than time on the range. I'm actually a criminal justice major, and that's something we talk about a lot in policy classes, but my flight instructor actually told me a good line. You never rise to the occasion. You always default to your highest level of training. And in a situation like that, if your highest level of training and the most training you've had is in shooting, it's only understandable, but you can see how they would default to shooting. I think we need more crisis management training, more person-to-person training, so we can eliminate these cases of needless violence.
All right. Some other reaction from our listeners. A comment from our website. President Trump threatens to veto the omnibus spending bill because it doesn't fix DACA. Perhaps someone should tell him that he was the one who broke DACA in the first place. He could fix it with another stroke of his pen. Another comment from our website about the president being angered about leaks about his conversation with Vladimir Putin, says, once again, the leaks are calls for help from the White House. Those next to the so-called president are frightened and want to warn the public that intervention is necessary. Now, another piece of a headline from President Trump. Trump and former President Biden, they sort of got into a war of words, threatening each other to a street fight. Trump tweeted that Biden, quote, would go down fast and hard, crying all the way. Tamara, what's going on?
Well, you know, here's what's really going on. Joe Biden is somebody who is on the list of the very, 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 very long list of people who could potentially run for president in 2020. And President Trump is very focused on 2020. Now, this is not the first time that Joe Biden has sort of talked about, you know, if Donald Trump said that around me, I'd take him out and rumble if I was a younger man and he was a younger man, kind of a thing.
They're both in their 70s and they're both talking like this.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. So the context is that Biden was talking about the Access Hollywood video while at an event related to stopping sexual assault. And you know, the Violence Against Women Act is something that is a very big part of Joe Biden's legacy. Yeah. And President Trump is never one to turn away from the opportunity for a good feud.
No, and late night host Seth Meyers called the Biden-Trump trash talk the thrilla in vanilla. that's a good characterization. Jack, quickly before we go, we know that Robert Mueller has some areas he wants to talk to the president about. It includes the investigation of the Jim Comey firing, the Russian contacts, that meeting at Trump Tower. What might we expect from this ahead?
Well, I think that the people are saying, the people who study these things, that it looks like Mr. Trump, in sort of jettisoning his, changing around his legal team, firing Andrew McCabe, is essentially laying down a predicate. Can I get away with firing Mr. Mueller? And, of course, the people in front of him. And he's testing the waters. What will Republican reaction be? There's been some strong reaction. Lindsey Graham said impeachment would be the result. But the Congress has not passed what they were talking about last summer, a bill that would say, don't do this, Mr. President, because that will essentially be an assault on the rule of law, and you can't get away with it. That hasn't happened. He hasn't got that red light from the Republicans in Congress.
All right. And the last word goes to Jack Beattie, an On Point news analyst. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you so much.
Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Terrific to have you with us today.
Thanks, Kim.
And Tamara Keith, White House correspondent for NPR. Thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. On our website, you'll find a link to sign up for our weekly email newsletter. You'll get behind-the-scenes access to On Point and exclusive features delivered to your inbox. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.